And go ahead and get. So, Amoga City, you can see on this little rupa that mudra, the fearless mudra. So he's very much associated with fearlessness and confidence. And confidence is another way that Shraddha is translated. So confidence and faith are how it's often translated. So there's also that sense of his confidence, his fearlessness in a way being connected to his practice, to his faith, to his spiritual ideals. And I think that's good to remember because I think for us that context can really help us when we're trying to deal with difficult things. I know for myself this last, well, it's over a year now, but with the COVID pandemic and the lockdown and a lot of anxiety and fears for myself and for others arising, it really helped to have the context of my spiritual practice, to have the Dharma and the teachings and the Dharma practices to help me through that. So I imagine that everybody in their everyday lives and in their meditation practice has come across times when they feel anxiety and fear, and sometimes it gets overwhelming, sometimes it can escalate, and certainly there's lots of times when it might make it difficult to continue your meditation practice, for instance, or avoiding things in your life. I've been working with that quite a lot more recently. And I think we have our core conditioning patterns going right back to when we were children that can get evoked in situations we're experiencing now. And we're not always conscious of that. So I think, yes, sometimes we are very clear of having specific fears and anxieties, but sometimes it's sort of almost unconscious. And we've developed so many patterns and habits and ways of dealing with it that we might not actually allow it into our consciousness. We can distract ourselves, suppress it, deny it, but it still has an effect. And there's a lot of energy that goes into either when we're getting ourselves in a state or when we're trying to contain that state or deny that state. So it's not surprising that when you are able to work with that fear effectively or transform it, there's a lot of energy released, you know, and that can then be directed into your practice, into skillful action, which is what Amoga City is also closely associated with. Head of the action family, the karma family, but not just acting for the sake of acting, it's very much a sense of acting out of that place of wisdom and compassion, you know, for the sake of all living beings. So sometimes it can feel like the Buddha or the Bodhisattvas are so far removed from us. They, you know, they've had that full awakening experience. They're enlightened beings, and we feel like we're so far away from them. You know, depending on what our particular habits and patterns are, that can be a discouragement, or it can be something that inspires us to try to put more energy into moving closer towards that. But there probably is that sense of us not being, you know, good enough sometimes in our practice. We often have these negative critical voices that can undermine us and our practice, which is why doubt is sort of quite a strong hindrance to our practice. Because in a way, if we doubt our, if we doubt the teachings and the possibility of change and transformation, if we doubt our ability to change and transform, well, what's the point? And it can maybe stop us from even sitting down to meditate or even trying to change. And underneath that, there's probably fear and anxiety. And because we're such complex beings, sometimes that fear and anxiety is about, you know, not being good enough, it not being possible, us failing. And sometimes that fear and anxiety may be about the fact that we might succeed We might make progress, we might change, we might become, you know, all the things that we could be, we might realize our potential. You know, that can sometimes be as scary as staying where we are and feeling that we can't. So as Paninita brought out yesterday, we make choices, don't we? We make a choice whether or not we want to embark on that journey of spiritual development, whether we want to follow the Buddhist path, become a Dharma practitioner, a Dharma wayfarer. Yeah? And when we make that choice, that sets a direction, that intention sets a direction. So whatever else is happening, however messy our lives are, however inconsistent we might be in our practice, just having made that decision and in a way started that journey makes a difference. And the more we practice and we can become more focused, more determined, have more continuity in our practice and more confidence in our practice, because when we practice, hopefully we'll see positive benefits, we will start to encounter change in ourselves. Well, that can also help us in that impetus, you know, and that very consciously directing our energy in pursuit of the good or ideals or what is meaningful or what can be beneficial to ourselves and others. But it's not easy, you know, spiritual path is very challenging. And I have always found it very encouraging to hear that the Buddha also experienced some of those fears and challenges. So I'm just going to sort of talk a little bit about one of the suttas, which is called the Bhayabharava Sutta, which is about fear and dread. And basically, the story in the sutta is that a Brahmin comes along to the Buddha and asks him some questions. And this is quite an interesting sutta because quite often you have people, groups or individuals coming to the Buddha and asking him for a teaching. And he gives them a teaching and then they get inspired. Sometimes they get enlightened or often they'll join him and become one of his followers. So in this case, rather than asking for a teaching, the Brahmin's clearly kind of interested in the Buddha and his community, but has a lot of reservations and doubts and concerns and fears about what it might be like being one of the Buddha's followers. So what he asks the Buddha is, when clansmen have gone forth from the home life into the homeless us out of faith in you, do they still have you as a leader, helper and a guide? And do those people all follow your example? Yeah. In a way, are they all living the same kind of life that you are living, you know, the same practices that you are doing? And the Buddha says, well, yes, that is true. When people do go forth and they join the homeless life and become my followers, I am still their leader, their guide, and I'd still help them. And yes, they, you know, they are expected to follow my example, you know. And then the Brahmin says, but Master Gotama, you know, because he's very much aware of the fact that the Buddha goes off and meditates in these remote places in the forest, in the jungle. He says, remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest are hard to endure. Seclusion is hard to practice. It's hard to enjoy solitude. And one would think that that being in that place would rob a bhikkhu of his mind if he hasn't got any concentration. Yeah. So what's interesting is the Buddha doesn't dismiss any of those fears. He just says, yes, that's right. You know, it is hard to endure being in those remote places in the forests. You know, it is hard to practice seclusion, and it is hard sometimes to enjoy solitude. And, you know, one would think that being there might rob you of your mind if you haven't got concentration. And then what he says is, actually, before I was enlightened, I had all of those thoughts, all of those fears, kind of thing. So he gives a quite personal account of his own way of working with fear and anxiety and dread. and all of his thought processes and all what happened when he's practicing. So he's sharing his personal experience and all the way to how, you know, through doing that, he's then able to gain insight, which then helps him lead towards enlightenment. And he goes into a lot of detail, which I'm not going to do into all of that. And then, yeah, so basically he's saying he's enlightened now, and then it's quite, I think it's quite sweet. He then says, well, you might wonder why I still go into all of these remote places to meditate, and if it means that I'm not really enlightened and I'm still working with everything. He says, no, I am, but I go there for two reasons. One is because I enjoy it, you know, in the here and now, it's pleasant to me to go off and meditate in the forest. But also he's doing it out of compassion for future generations. And then the Brahmin gets very inspired and he decides to go forth and join the Buddha's followers. So that's the basic outline of the sutta. And I'm going to read a few extracts from that and maybe draw out some things from it. Yeah. So one of the things that when the Buddha's admitting that he had those same worries, those same concerns, you know, he also then goes into a whole process of considering, well, why do people get into those difficult, challenging mental states? And he thinks it's basically because people are still, you know, their ethical conduct, their bodily ethical conduct, their verbal ethical conduct, and also the state of their mind is not yet purified. You know, so he thinks that those people who go forth and they meditate there and they've got a mind full of lust or covetousness or ill will, intentions of hate, or maybe they've got, you know, he lists this, all of the hindrances, actually, sloth and torpor, restlessness, being unpeaceful in your mind, uncertainty and doubt. And also things like being full of self-praise, disparaging others, being susceptible to alarm and terror, being desirous of gain, honor and renown, lacking in energy, not being aware or mindful. So these are all conditions that can lead to one getting into these states of fear and anxiety. And then he reflects that actually he doesn't think he has that. He thinks that he has... he does act in a skillful way, and that he has a peaceful mind. He's got a mind of loving kindness. He's gone beyond doubt, you know, and he doesn't have all those things, basically, the alarm, the fear. He says that he's established in mindfulness. He's got a good concentrated mind. So he thinks it's not necessarily going to be an issue for him if he does it, but he's still anxious about it. The next thing he thinks is about, well, a particular time when he might do it, as precious days. And then once he actually starts about actually going to meditate in the forest, in these scary places, he thinks, now what if I were to dwell in such awe-inspiring, horrifying abodes as orchard shrines, woodland shrines, and tree shrines? Perhaps I might encounter that fear and dread. So he's not actually even in that situation, and he's wondering whether he's going to be experiencing fear and dread. So that's exactly what we do, isn't it? We have the fear of an experience before we're actually having the experience, which may or may not be as scary as we're thinking. So he has those fears in advance, and then he says, and when I dwelt there, a wild animal would come up to me, or a peacock would knock off a branch, or a wind would rustle the winds. And I thought, what now, if this is the fear and dread coming? So the things that are sort of throw him off, he's not completely in that state, but he's wondering if it's going to come because of that. But then he has quite a lot of awareness, because he thinks, well, why do I always dwell expecting fear and dread? So he's noticing that's a pattern that he has, that expectation of fear and dread. And he thinks, well, how can I work with that? What if I subdue that fear and dread while keeping the same posture that I'm in when it comes upon me? And then he describes actually how the fear and dread did come upon him and what he did. So, while I walked, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither stood nor sat nor lay down till I had subdued that fear and dread. While I stood, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked nor sat nor lay down till I had subdued that fear and dread. While I sat, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked nor stood nor lay down until I'd subdued that fear and dread. And while I lay down, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked nor stood nor sat down till I had subdued that fear and dread. So basically, he experiences fear and dread in all the different postures, and I suppose it also implies that maybe not just when he's meditating, but in the rest of his daily life. And what he does is he tries to just be with it, not pushing it away, not denying it, just allowing himself to experience it fully. And that was his strategy in a way of working with the fear and dread. And actually, he says that tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness established. My body was tranquil, my mind untroubled and concentrated and unified. So there's something about when you're dealing with all these fear and dread and your mind gets scattered and anxious, your body gets in a state, all that energy that's taken up in that and in trying to deal with your fear or trying to, deny it or suppress it, that all got released once he stopped doing that. And then he talks about the experience that once he's got that release of energy, once he is more concentrated, then he goes through this whole process, going through the dhyanas. So basically establishing himself in very positive mental states, and then from there, a lot of insight arising. And I think I'm not going to say much more about that particular sutta, but there's something about before we can really go for the wisdom insight practice, we do actually need to have established ourselves in a positive state. So we talk about shamatha practice and vipassana practice, with the shamatha practice having very much a focus on establishing ourselves in calm mental states, in integrated states, in positive mental states. And then the vipassana, once you've established that, once you've got that basis, then you go into the insight practice. So I don't think it's as clear cut as that, because I think right from the start, we're having awareness, we're having insight, and they can work alongside each other. But I do think there is something about when we start, actually, a lot of the work is about getting ourselves in a better place. So all those bundle of selves, all the conditioning, the views, the anxiety, the fear, all are particular things that we're working with. Maybe it's envy, maybe it's craving, maybe we're a bit deluded around lots of, well, we all are deluded, yeah. But we work with our stuff basically, and we get to a certain place as a result of our practice of positivity, and then it's much more easy to go for the insight practice. And I suppose I'm just thinking, especially like in terms of, it's not necessarily helpful if you're in a complete state, a lot of anxiety, or say you're in depression or something, or you've had a bereavement or something that's really challenging, to just necessarily sit there meditating, not able to do something, getting yourself in more of a state. I think unless you've actually reached a certain place in your practice where there is that calm established, there is a lot more resources there. That's not at all helpful, and especially if there's past trauma there, it's not necessarily helpful. So I think we need to have self-metta, but being willing to turn towards and sit with some of our fears, sit with some of our anxieties, but not necessarily for hours on end, even if it's just for a little while. And then we aware of it, we acknowledge it, and we come back to it in the future, work with it in the future. But that is all part of this process of integration, of seeing what's there, acknowledging what's there, being able to turn towards the difficult stuff with kindness, you know, and compassion towards ourselves. And I think it's helpful to just think, well, it's not just us, the Buddha had to do all of that too, yeah? So the other story that I wanted to draw on, as I said, it's the story about when the Buddha gave the teaching of the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So we have this commentary by this teacher, Buddha Ghosha, who wasn't a contemporary of the Buddha. I think he was around a few hundred years later, but certainly at least 2,000 years ago. And he's actually, interestingly, the person that came up with the form of the mindfulness of breathing that we practice within Tri Ratna. So his commentary is about the occasion for the recitation of the Metta Sutta, and when the loving kindness sutta was spoken by the Buddha to his followers. And again, that's a nice story, I think. So there was a tradition that during the rainy season, which was like last for 3 months, that all the bhikkhus would come together and practice. And in the early days, they'd all come and join the Buddha, and you know, he would be giving them teachings, and they'd be practicing together for that 3 months. Now, obviously, over the years, because he was teaching for over like 40 years or something after his enlightenment, you know, there were more and more bhikkhus, and some coming from other countries, and they couldn't all fit with him in one place. So what often they would do is, before the rainy season, they'd come to the Buddha, you know, get a teaching, and then go off with their particular community to practice together. So we're told that before the rainy season, there's a group of like 500 bhikkhus who come to the Buddha to take teaching, particularly around meditation. And apparently that was something the Buddha did. And yeah, it does intrigue me, because it sort of says that, let me see if I can find it. Yes, he expounded meditation subjects suitable for the 84,000 shades of temperament in following the way. So it's basically 84,000 ways that, you know, we might be different in our practice and our different temperaments. And the Buddha was aware of all of those, and he was giving different teachings that he thought would be suitable for different people. So it's not one size fits all. Yeah. And it gives a few examples, like those with a lustful temperament. He gave meditation on loathsomeness. Those who had a lot of hating, he gave them the Brahma Viharas meditations. Those with deluded temperaments, he'd give them meditations on death. Those of a speculative thinking temperament, which I imagine a lot of us fall into, he gave both the mindfulness of breathing, the earth universal, and other teachings. And those of a faithful temperament, subjects consisting of things like the recollections of the enlightened one. So recollecting the Buddha is an actual practice. And those of intelligent, discovering temperament, the definition of the four elements. So that's only a few out of the 84,000, but you get a sense that he's, you know, he's basically meeting people where they are and thinking, well, what do you need? What do you particularly need in your practice to work on? And what would be a good meditation? You know, and I think we have to do that in a way a lot for ourselves, is try out various teachings and practices, and we know what is working for us, what is helpful for us at a particular time, and that might change. Yeah. But anyway, so they've got their teaching, and they go off together to find a suitable place to practice for the 3 months. And they come across this place in the Himalayan mountains, and it was really beautiful, you know? And there's also cool, shady forest groves, nice places for them to sort of set up. I had a clear spring with grateful cool water. Is in this, I don't know how the water was grateful, but anyway, it's lovely wording. And And it also happens to be near two towns where they can go for their arms practice. So we're told that what they say. So once they'd found the place, they'd spent a night there, and all is doing. They decide to go to one of the towns for their arms. And apparently, the town was connected with 1,000 clans. It was a community residence of people who had faith and confidence. And since it was hard in those days for people in these remote places, in the outlands, at the mountain, to get a sight of all these holy men, these bhikkhus, they were really happy that this group of bhikkhus had come. And they begged them to stay for the 3 months and said they would feed them. And actually, they create huts for them and they give them all kinds of resources. And so it's a really, on some ways, it seems like a perfect place for them. Yeah. And they also visit the other town and people are just as welcoming. However, in this forest, in the trees, there were all these tree deities living, or tree sprites. And they were a bit put out with all these monks arriving, and they leave when the monks arrive because they think they're just coming for a little while. And then they realize that they're going to be there for 3 months. And then they think, we can't live out away from our trees, and our children away from home for so long. So let's try and scare these bhikkhus away. And so we hear that, especially during the night when they're meditating, they create terrifying spirits, stand in front of each of them, make dreadful noises. And then the bhikkhus saw these and their hearts quailed and they grew pale and they couldn't concentrate. And then they were harassed again and again. And they also bring bad smells that enter into their brains and give them feelings of oppression in their heads. But none of them mention to each other that this has been going on. So they're all experiencing it, but none of them mention it to each other. And then one day, the sort of head of their community summons them all together, their elder, and he says, when you first came along, you're all in such a great state. Skin was clear and pure, your faculties were clear, but now you all seem like lean and pale and jaundiced and shaky, and what's going on, basically? So then one of the monks just admits, at night, when I sit down, I see and hear such and such dreadful things, and there's such a dreadful smell, and my mind's not concentrated, and this has been going on, for a long time. And once he said that, then all the others say, oh, well, yes, that's exactly my experience. At night, I saw and heard such and such a dreadful object, and heard such and such a dreadful sound, smelt such a dreadful sound, and I couldn't concentrate, and I was really anxious and scared. And they decide then, oh, this is clearly not a good place. So although it looks like it's a good place, let's go. And they decide to go back to the Buddha and ask him to tell them of another place that would be better. He's a bit, when they come back, they say, well, what are you doing? It's the middle of the rainy season. Shouldn't you be practicing somewhere? And they explain what's happened and ask him to find somewhere. So he looks with his special Buddha eye and he basically says, actually, there's nowhere. There's nowhere that would be better for you to practice than this particular place. So you need to go back there. If you go back there, then you probably will be able to, rid yourself of some taints and all this kind of stuff. So go back there. So they're not that happy about that, just being told to go back. But then what the Buddha does is he says, bhikkhus, there is no other resting place that will suit you. It is only by living there you might reach the exhaustion of the taints. So go and occupy that same resting place. But if you want to be free from fear of the deities, then learn this safeguard, for it will be both a safeguard and a meditation subject for you. And then he recites the Karaniya Metta Sutta, which is all about metta, basically. Practice of metta, the principles of metta. And then we're told that when the monks return and they're chanting it as they're returning, all the tree deities actually are very moved by this, and they welcome them back to the forest, and actually they keep them safe all the time they're there. So it has a really transformative effect on the tree deities and also on their relationship with them, and it makes it possible for them to coexist together happily. So I'm just going to leave you to draw your own conclusions from that story, but I'm going to read the Karaniya Metta Sutta, and then we'll have a maybe just a few minutes to sit and absorb that before we go into doing some meditation practice. But maybe if you get ready into your meditation posture, and then just settle and arrive, and I'll read it once you've done that. The Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is a translation from the Amaravati Sangha, Thai forest tradition. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful. Not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life a child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths. Outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Okay, so before we do the metta bhavana practice, I thought I'd just share a few thoughts and reflections about the practice. I suppose one thing I was thinking is, well, why did the Buddha encourage his followers to go into those remote places to meditate by themselves, even though he had his personal experience and he knew that it's hard to endure being in the forest? Seclusion is hard, solitude is hard, and there is that possibility of if you're not concentrated, you haven't established that calm, it's going to have a detrimental effect on your mental states, knowing that people are likely to encounter fear and anxiety in those conditions. So it sounds like he's sort of aware that people actually do need to turn towards that, do need to experience that as part of their practice to be able to transform, release, and integrate those experiences and free that energy. And it's not something we do just once, it's something we do again and again, like with all our practice, practice on the cushion, practice in daily life. That's why ethics is a practice, that's why meditation is a practice. We keep on doing it, keep on doing it. And even in small incremental steps, maybe it has an effect, even if we're not aware of it at the time. Because meditation is quite an interesting thing, isn't it? You can do it by yourself and you can do it with others. And when we do it with others, we are still having individual experiences. We are still working with our own minds, but there's something about collective practice and the energy that can be really supportive, which is one of the reasons it's nice to, go to centers and classes or go on retreat. But ultimately, we're with our own minds and we're working with our own conditioning and we're on our own path. But I think sometimes when we're around others, it's very easy to distract ourselves or get caught up in other things. So there is some value of actually just being by ourselves, and it's much harder to stick with it, doesn't it? If you've actually removed yourself physically and you've gone into a remote place, then you can't just immediately get in contact with someone or talk with someone. There is that necessity to actually sit with it, be with it, and see what happens. But then what, I suppose what was there for me in both of those is that he's not like forcing himself, you must do this, why are you having these fears, don't be so ridiculous. There is a sense of kindness there, sense of compassion there towards himself. And in that other story, when he's giving the Karaniya Metta Sutta to the band of bhikkhus, that he's basically saying, if you're experiencing all this fear, there's the fear within, but there's also the fear of those deities who were actually trying to scare you. They were being hostile towards you, but try and meet that with kindness. And I think it's the intention very much in the practice. It's not saying that when you sit down and do the practice, in every stage of the practice, every time you sit, you're going to feel loving kindness towards people. Quite often you're going to be experiencing all kinds of other things, which may include fear, which may include ill will and hatred or envy or all sorts of other things that are not loving kindness. But that's part of the practice, it's a antidote to fear, it's an antidote to ill will, but the whole idea is that through creating that, in a way, that metta through working with Meta, we're able to hold and be and respond with those and transform those. But first of all, we need to actually allow them to be there and ourselves to see them and ourselves to experience them. Try to not get into judging ourselves around what we're experiencing, because that's what we're experiencing, but meet it with kindness, meeting it with compassion, meet it with awareness. Yeah. So in each of the different stages, you know, they do have different feels to them. But bearing in mind, you know, there's 84,000 temperaments, you know, and the Buddha trying to adapt different meditations for them, I think we can feel some ownership over our practice. And if doing the metta bhavana in the five stages, as you were originally taught, doesn't feel right, if it feels like you need to miss out a stage or spend more time on a particular stage, or practice metta in a more body-based, breath-based way, or, you know, not, you know, in a more free-form way, then that's fine. That may be what you need to do. I think it's useful to still come back to the form and the structure, not abandon it completely, but yeah, have a bit of sensitivity, have a bit of kindness, compassion, and also a lot of awareness about, well, what is appropriate for you at a particular time. Sometimes it may mean that you need to spend loads of time on the first stage. Yeah. Sometimes it may be that you find it difficult to do a particular stage. Well, then it's interesting. Why is it difficult? Why is it challenging? It's probably something in there to turn towards and explore. But every stage of the metta bhavana is actually a mirror to ourselves, tells us more about ourselves than the other person. And in fact, you know, it's not that we're actually got the actual person with us when we're meditating. It's our own internalized mental construct of those people that may or may not be real or accurate. Yeah. But it gives us an opportunity to work with those tendencies in our mind, the ways that we relate to others in the world. So how we relate to ourselves, how we relate to people we like and care about, you know, our friends, and then how we might relate to people that we, you know, we don't really know, they're not important to us, we see them about, we interact with them, but maybe, you know, we don't even necessarily take them in as people, we just use them, you know, as our function for something we want, you know, someone at the end of the phone, someone, you know, at the end of a checkout, you know, bus conductor or driver, you know. We might not even say hello or look at them or acknowledge them as a human being. We might just do what we want and walk past. Yeah. So it's actually beginning to break that habit of not seeing them as people just like us. And in the fourth stage, well, those feelings of ill will. Now, I think a lot of people in the fourth stage think they must always choose someone they've got very strong feelings of ill will towards or hatred towards, and if they don't, they're copping out, which isn't the case at all. You know, in a way, it might be more helpful sometimes to choose someone that there's just a bit of aversion, you don't particularly want to spend some time with them, or you find them boring, you're a bit judgmental towards them, they wind you up, press your buttons, but they're not like your worst enemy and they haven't deeply harmed you or someone that you care about, you know. We can build towards that, but I think let's be realistic and let's also develop our confidence in our ability to work with our ill will and hatred before we go for the people where there's really deep-seated, very strong feelings. You know, there will be time enough for that if you keep on practicing, and it can be really effective. Certainly I've had that experience myself. But you can find that you go straight for somebody and it blows whatever positivity you've developed out of the water, and then that can be quite undermining for yourself. I'd also invite you not to always choose the same person, and not to see the metta bhavana in a sort of as a tool. Well, it can be a tool for working with our ill will and hatred, and probably if you practiced it, you may have had that experience that when you put people in the meditation, particularly in the fourth stage, sometimes it shifts a difficult dynamic, or you find your heart opening or more of a connection, and then in real life something happens that's more positive. So that's great about your practice, but that's not necessarily the aim of the practice, which is to transform our minds and work with those states. So I think we can often think, oh, this person's, I'm having difficulty with this person, let's stick them in the metta bhavana and then hope that'll fix it. You know, so it's not using the metta bhavana as a way to fix our difficult dynamics and relationships, but it's a way of working with our responses, our reactions, our habits, our views, our conditioning, and all the things that get in the way of us inhabiting, dwelling in the metta that we all do have within, that can get blocked or overwhelmed by other things, yeah? And not letting us be receptive to the kindness from others as well. And in that final stage, we're just basically trying to connect with other living beings, whether or not we will ever see them, whether or not we know them or not. In a way, connecting with life, recognizing that interconnection with all those other living beings and the things we have in common, not just focusing on difference and making them other. You know, trying to, in a way, go beyond that most fundamental delusion of ourselves as this fixed separate being that's the basis for all the other dualities that we then experience and encounter and propagate during our lives. But in a way, I would just keep it simple. I think throughout the practice, it's not just the people you bring to mind you're bringing metta towards, it's also anything that's arising in your experience. So if there's pain or discomfort in your body, bringing metta towards that. If there's difficult emotions, feelings, reactions, bring metta towards that. If there are thoughts that are challenging or troubling, or things that you're not proud of in your response, you know, you may have a view of yourself as this kind spiritual person, then you find yourself having a murderous fantasy about someone. Well, just bring kindness to that, yeah? So bring awareness, bring kindness to whatever's arising, and that's all you need to do in this practice. Just be with what is, whatever is there, and bring kindness and awareness to it. So we're going to do a period of the metta bhavana. I think I've been talking a lot, so I'm not going to lead it. Everyone has their own way or ways of doing it, and it's good to experiment and play with those. So I'm just going to ring the bells to mark the stages. And then at the end, I'll start us off in the Maitri mantra. So Maitri being the Sanskrit version of metta. So when we're chanting this mantra, we're trying to connect with metta, the metta within us, the metta around us, and allow that to be boundless and limitless. Bhavana. So that brings this morning's session to a close. So thank you all for being here and practicing. And time has gone quite quickly. So we only have one more session on the retreat, so do try and come to that session. I think endings are really important, and it'll be a little bit of a chance to bring together some of what we've been experiencing on the retreat. There'll be groups where you can report out. There'll be stuff in the bigger session as well as some meditation and ritual. So hope hope to see you all at 4 o'clock. And yeah, have a nice lunch, afternoon, or breakfast, or whatever it is, wherever you are. And yes, do feel free to post in the chat or unmute as you leave.